I am Roy Malloy, and this is an extra podcast for The Dawn of Crime, just a little bit outside the usual. I'm going to be doing a podcast today about a very historical crime, one that's probably one of our earliest, certainly in Victoria. This crime is one that is a little bit close to my heart. You see, as far as history goes, my great-great-grandfather, so that's my, follow this if you can, right? If you're playing along at home, see if you can follow this. My mum's dad's mum's dad. he was a fascinating guy, and he was born in Whitehall in England. And he was the son of a barrister and the grandson of a solicitor. And they'd done pretty well for themselves to come up in the world, and they were doing, you know, making a family dynasty, I guess. And they sent this poor lad off to college, and he went to university to learn how to be a lawyer. And when he got there, in his first semester, so the story goes, he said, "Mum, Dad, I joined a club at uni." They said, "Fantastic. What is it? Archery? Rugby? Rowing?" He said, none of that. "I'm going to be an actor." So we're talking the late 1840s now. And, I mean, they all went to the theatre, but actually being an actor, if you're a high-born person, that's like being, you know, on the game by choice. So this guy, he was exiled by the family. He went to Ballarat shortly thereafter, and he went, not in search of gold, he went there to be an actor. And there was a lady called Mrs. Hamner. She had a theatre in a tent, and he acted for a part of that time with Mrs. Hamner in that tent. He was there the night the Eureka Stockade happened. So then this story has a crossover to me personally there, that my great-great-grandfather, Arthur Wellesley Arnold, was at the Eureka Stockade, and he was an actor. There was another guy, and his name was Carboni. And Carboni is a fascinating guy. He was an author, he was an actor, he was a shepherd. But he was one of those people that really, he fell for the underdog. Now, Raffaello Carboni, his full name, he came to Australia looking for opportunity. He was an exile, actually, a political exile. And he came to Australia, and he was a shepherd for a time. And he says in his own words that he lost his sheep, and he was in that kind of that Golden Triangle area, which is known to the First National people as the land of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung. It's also part of the Kulin Nation, which is a group of five different nations, and their shared territory is the Kulin Nation. And so he's in a part of that, which is the Dja-Dja-Wurrung tribal area. And he turns to them and he says, "Look, I've completely lost my sheep." And they helped him find them. And he was very affable and very praising of them. And so, I've enjoyed that story. But then he went forwards and he was at the Eureka Stockade as well. He was a theatrical kind of bloke, and he later on went on to write plays. Maybe a long bow, but I'd have to imagine that he was in Ballarat at the time of the stockade, as was my great-great-grandfather. They're both theatrical guys. That would be a very small pool to fish in. I mean, I know there were a lot of people in Ballarat, but when you narrow down the theatrical types, I'd have to imagine that they probably crossed paths. So he'd left. He was at Ballarat when the stockade happened. He was arrested as part of the group who were at the centre of it, and he was put in Old Melbourne Jail. While he was there, he wrote a story called Gilburnia. Now, the story of Gilburnia is one of kidnap, potential possible rape, murder, but its cast and setting are entirely, or not entirely, but are mainly indigenous. And that's a very rare story. It's a very rare pantomime. I'm aware that the pantomime that it's written to be a stage play, Gilburnia. It's. I don't believe it's ever been produced. Now, as somebody myself who owns two theatres, it would be a hard one to stage because it's written from the perspective of somebody who's very affectionate to the cause and the plight of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung. But I do believe that well-intended, but he's also approaching the story from that of the conqueror. You know, we say that history is written by the victors. He's in that category, even though he paints the white guys as the bad guys. He uses colloquialisms that we would now think as unacceptable. You know, he also puts a key in the beginning of the book that that outlines what he believes to be actual Zha Zha Warang language. I think there's maybe as many as a dozen words in his 30 or so words that are actually Zha Zha Warang language, but the rest of them are they're kind of pidgin English, or they're slang that white people used in that time, thinking they knew something about the culture and they didn't. So he does well to try, because it's far above and beyond that of the cultural sensitivity of anybody at the time. But it's not, you know, it would be hard to produce it, put it that way. But the story of Jules Bernier is that he believes that the word Gilles is in, and it's a G, not a J, but he spells it G-I-L, which in Italian is pronounced with a J sound. But the G-I-L part of the name refers to flowers in particular. And then the Gilles Bern is a crown of those flowers. So to say Jules Bernier is like saying the one who wears the crown. Now in white culture, we say the anointed one, which is then the king. So it places a reference on her that she's a princess or a queen. And in the opening stages, they talk about her wearing a crown, and her father, you know, has hopes of her leading and all those kinds of things. So she's a royal person in this story. So then we skip forwards, and as I'm reading the story, I'm made aware of everything it tends to have a kernel of truth in it. I found with every story I've ever written or seen written, even someone like J.K. Rowling leaned on her own life experiences to, you know, to draw out these parts of her story, even though it's complete fiction. Right? But in the story of Jules Bernier, I thought, you know, where has this been? You know, where's he found this story from? He did spend time with the Jara of the Zha Zha Warang people. And so I was keen to find out where this happened. Right? And so I started looking, and I started digging in there. And I went to Trove, and I went to the newspapers. And in there, I found a newspaper article reference, which blew my mind. Now, it happens within 18 months, it's roughly, because he's not exact with when he's shepherding and when he meets the Zha Zha Warang. He also would have met a fair few people who had indigenous backgrounds on the goldfields, because they were plentiful as well. We think it was just a white guy territory, and it wasn't. There was plenty of black people on the diggings. But he finds himself there, and there's a story that takes place in Ballarat, in and around that 1853 period, 54 period, just leading up to the Eureka Stockade. And I'll read it to you from the newspaper article, right? So the newspaper article reads, it's talking about two white miners who have come down from the hills in 1850, and they've kind of spent every cent they've got, and they're still bored and they're not drunk enough, right? So these are two guys who have been alone for a long time as well, thinking Brokeback Mountain, I guess. So the newspaper article reads, after dissipating every farthing, they prowled about the suburbs of the town until meeting with a solitary lubra. Now, lubra is slang and racist for a lady who is of Zha Zha Warang. So she's a black lady, and she's on the outskirts of town. Now, she's not in the town, she's on the outskirts, which then probably leads you to think that she was coming or going from their actual own territory. So it's kind of got that invasion ring to it. And they wheeled her away beyond the outskirts of the main area of the town with promises until they deemed themselves in security, when they revealed their intentions by commanding the unfortunate and deluded creature to accompany them to the forest. It was in vain that she declined, resisted, implored, and her shrieks were lost in the deep melancholies of the forest. So then he goes on to talk about what they did to her, and they outraged her. The outrage is the word they used. But then it's not quite the end of the story. So in Gilburnium, Carbonia also talks about the love interest of this queen, avenging her. And he goes looking for her. And so I won't give away either of the stories, but he takes a throwing club, like a boomerang, but it's a throwing club, and he kills one of the white guys who kidnapped her for his own. Well, in this actual news story, it talks about how the people from her area, 14 of them, they take arms of their own, and one would imagine they're spears. I don't know necessarily if they had guns, but it's not out of the question. And they go hunting for these two white guys. So let's say we skip forward then a couple of years, 3 years. And at this time, Raffaello Carboni is now losing his sheep in the woods. And he says to he says, "Hey, over there, you guys, you live in this area. Have you seen some sheep?" They'd be pretty cautious of any white guy at this point, I reckon. And they say, "Yeah, all right." So they help him find their sheep. Let's assume they have the ability between the two languages to have a conversation. A few years have passed now. It's not impossible that this story came up. But we all know that, like, you know, with the passage of time and Chinese whispers and egos, stories become better. That's why, when we're researching, if we find a diary that's written that day, we think of it very much as a primary reference. But years and years later, we look at the story with a grain of salt because the story gets embellished over time. Let's give it a couple of years now, and they're recounting this story to Carboni. They say, and this happened, and this, and he was a hero. And they add bits like where they caught them, but didn't maybe necessarily. They add that she was a princess, where maybe she wasn't. I don't know. I just know that even if they told him the bones of the story, I wonder whether this story, which would have been incredibly well known to the Jara of the Jaja Warung, the people, whether this is the story that is the kernel, and the kernel of truth that is the beginning point of this play that Carboni wrote at the old Melbourne jail when he was locked up for treason for being part of the Eureka Stockade. You could never know. He's dead, long dead. It's a fascinating book. It's a great play, and it's spelled GILBURNIA. I'll put a picture of it as the thumbnail to this podcast. But I found that a thoroughly interesting story. It's something I've been working on for a little bit. I'd love you guys to check out more of my work. If you are on social media, make sure you jump on Facebook and look up Roy Malloy, author. So you've actually got to write the word author. So it's my last name is spelled M-A-L-O-Y. So it's Roy Malloy, author. I got a bunch of stories there that I've published as well, that are short biographies of Australian criminals or crimes. I've also got a book series called The Dawn of Crime, and this podcast is dedicated to it. And if you just jump on Google and look up The Dawn of Crime by Roy Malloy, you've got to write the word by and Roy Malloy, we come up with them. In each book I put 12 to 14 different biographies of criminals. In one of them I've got the biography of the hangman who hung Ned Kelly. He put a rope around Ned Kelly's neck and he pulled the trigger. I don't know if he pulled the trigger, but he certainly was the hangman. I got a fascinating story in the first edition about an old lady who was the sly grog, illegal alcohol queen of Melbourne, and by and large she's gone completely unrecognised. And we placed on Squizzy Taylor, and we say, oh, he was selling grog, but this woman was making mass quantities of alcohol that even the police in court said, and it was really good, it tasted really good. She was making high quality mass amounts of sly grog. I'd love you guys to check these stories out. Send me a message if you have a family story of your own. I'm always keen to do a research, so get in touch. Thank you for listening, and I'll look forward to uploading something in the future.